This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name's Alex Perney. Today, we're going to be covering how someone can go from being a corrections officer all the way up to a successful real estate investor, investing in everything from single family homes to apartment syndication. But first, on the download, it's kind of an interesting story across the board when looking at the markets. The U.S. Treasury sank and stocks dropped after the Federal Reserve signaled that the central bank is still actually intent on raising rates until inflation is under control. Last Wednesday, they raised the prime lending rate by 75 basis points, which was another 75 basis point increase. And they have signaled that they, I guess, are not done with doing this in order to try to get inflation under control. So it will certainly be interesting to watch on just how far the rates will rise and what this will ultimately trickle down to. I mean, this might definitely be good for bond market and treasury bond market yields. But when it comes to the average investor, especially for those of us that are looking to borrow money, or companies that need to borrow a lot of money, especially banks and brokerages, the squeeze will definitely be on for at least the next foreseeable future. So looking at that as a metric of what is being done to try to combat inflation and to hopefully ease us out of the recession that we are most likely moving into will be something to closely watch. Now, in more centric news to the market, Twitter has begun subpoenaing records related to the shareholder suit against Elon Musk, which is slated to start October 17th. This is mainly centered towards the Brookfield Asset Management infusion of $250 million into this deal. However, even with these subpoenas, Twitter is still trading up at almost $50 per share, about $40.96 today. So really not much has changed with regard to share price on Twitter. However, the Twitter share price that Elon Musk agreed to pay is still significantly higher than that, at a little bit more than $54 per share. Now, one interesting thing to come out of this whole Twitter shareholder suit is that several of the investment firms that were ultimately invested with Elon Musk to take Twitter private are old colleagues, or at least have old track records with Elon Musk himself, coming from his days at PayPal before he was ousted in 2002. And some of them that own some of these asset management firms, the private asset management firms, even sit on boards of things like Tesla and SpaceX. So seeing how some of these lawsuits and some of these subpoenas are going to play out will definitely be interesting to see what kind of things are going to be unearthed in this. So for nothing else, then maybe some, let's call it entertaining financial news. We'll definitely get to see how this all plays out with this lawsuit, and especially with how quickly it is moving forward, we are likely to see large document dumps and a very large amount of information come out that we may not otherwise see, with the ability of the attorneys on both sides being able to file motions to suppress and not actually provide these types of informative documents. So the Twitter saga is continuing, and that's kind of where we're at right now. We did have a new jobs report come out last week showing 10.7 million openings, which is the lowest, since September of last year, and it's the largest sustained slide since the same time in 2020. However, this still shows unemployment at almost a 50-year low. Now, analysts and talking heads in general are kind of all across the board with this, but it is definitely something interesting to see when we are seeing markets take a significant decline. We're seeing things like inflation and all of these numbers continuing to climb. However, people are continuing to find employment, and employment numbers being low. But this really does point to a lack of earnings of these employed people. Just because, you know, these people happen to be employed doesn't mean that the squeeze is not on when inflationary measures are so extremely high, as they have been over the course of this year in 2022. So jobs reports coming out every month. We'll continue to see how this goes, but we are starting to see at least a little bit of a slide in that, which has kind of been one of the main sticking points that a lot of people, especially when we're looking at what the government's saying about the economy, has been a sticking point and kind of a shining beacon of saying, hey, maybe this isn't as bad as everyone is saying it is, because unemployment numbers are low and employment numbers are high. But if people aren't making enough money to afford these rising prices, then it's not that hard to see how this can actually potentially be a very bad thing for people. Now, last week, I know we focused a lot on cryptocurrency in the entirety of the podcast, and there really isn't a whole lot more to say on that. However, one interesting piece of information coming out, especially regarding the trading giant Robinhood, which is not strictly just a cryptocurrency exchange platform. They do offer their services to people. Just got hit with a $30 million fine by New York State regulators for violating anti-money laundering laws. That's a tough one to say a few times fast. That were based on the Know Your Customer protocols not being used correctly during automated trades back about 3 to 4 years ago. This news really hasn't affected their share price of $9.03. However, their share price of $9.03 is almost 50% down on what they were trading at the beginning of the year. So while the news in the short term isn't necessarily so bad for them, a $30 million fine for a company as large as they are is certainly not hard to pay. When it comes to what their share price is compared to where it was at the beginning of the year, definitely some pain at the pump when it comes to looking at that. So just something kind of interesting coming out of cryptocurrency, not a whole lot to report back on, you know, the still ongoing lawsuits with regard to places freezing customer withdrawals and things like that. And also the different types of bankruptcies still quite going on, still quite in the mix as far as what is going on with those different matters. So we'll keep you updated as to what happens with things like Voyager and Celsius as more news becomes available. But currently, everything from the podcast last week is still holding on track. One big piece of information before we leave you on the download that I found kind of interesting is that JP Morgan has officially become the largest by volume brokerage, largest by volume of revenue brokerage in the US, unseating Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley for the first time since 2006. It's always kind of interesting to see when there's a new top dog in town. And right now, that's JP Morgan. So if you wanted to invest in the stock market with someone who is the largest game in town, that is the place that's doing the most volume for brokerage right now in the US, unseating the likes of Goldman and Morgan Stanley. With that said, that's the download. Today on the what is enterprise value? With so much, and for lack of a better term, stock being put in what the value of a company is in today's market, it's important to understand some of the different metrics and terms that people are using to determine what a value of a particular company or share is. Enterprise value. What is enterprise value? It is a measure of a company's total value, often used as a more comprehensive alternative to equity market capitalization. Enterprise value, or EV, includes in its calculation the market capitalization of a company, but also short-term and long-term debt as well as any cash on the company's balance sheet. Enterprise value is a popular metric used to value a company for a potential takeover. Specifically, when we're looking at things like the takeover of for Elon Musk of Twitter, enterprise value is something that was laid on very hard with regard to the pegging of the share price at $54 when the buyout offer was tendered. Enterprise value is a measure of a company's total value, and the value often includes in its calculation not only market capitalization, but is used for the basis of many financial ratios and measures that determine the performance of a company. This is the what is, and that is enterprise value. Hi, and I'd like to welcome onto the podcast today, Zane Grazer. Thanks so much for being on with us today, Zane.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll kind of get into it. You have an extremely interesting story kind of that leads up to you being invested in commercial real estate. We've had a lot of different people that invest in commercial real estate syndications, everything from apartment buildings to commercial real estate, industrial, car washes and self-storage. But one thing I'd like to focus on, I think that kind of gets overlooked, is the life story of people that have come into this. A lot of people think that maybe you need to have some type of, incredibly strong background before getting into investing in commercial real estate, or, you know, if you're not involved in real estate from day one, that you can't do it. And I think Zane, your story is a really great one to kind of illustrate just how different backgrounds of people can come into this and be successful with it. So if you don't mind, let's kind of start at the beginning with, your professional career. And, you know, it's definitely not something that a lot of people would think, you know, starting from here, you know, ending up in commercial real estate. So I'll let you kind of lead off from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I did not get involved in real estate right away. I was still kind of figuring out my whole life and what I really wanted to do with my life. That took a while for me to figure it all out. But if I want to go back to the very beginning of my life, I was born early and my esophagus was not connected to my stomach. So I had to be airlifted for life-saving surgery for that. And then a few years after that, I had to go back in for surgery to fix the heart murmur that I had, which is a hole in my heart. And the surgery was over $100,000, which my parents could not afford to pay. And the insurance would not pay for it at that time. And I only had a 15% chance of survival for surgery. And there was an anonymous donor that came along and gave the money for a life-saving surgery. And I had a pretty normal and active childhood growing up. I was a happy person, so I didn't really think about what I had to go through when I was a young age, you know. And I was also born deaf. So I've had a lot of challenges associated with my deafness. So growing up, while going to school, I've always had to have an interpreter and a lot of services and support that I needed. I also missed out a lot of things. I could not have a conversation with a lot of people, and I don't hear a lot of things. So I was always behind in my learning curve in life. So it just took a lot longer for me to figure things out as I got older. And then finally, I went off to college and I graduated. And then I got a career with the state of Washington working for the Department of Correction. I was running the recreation program for the offenders, and I was working in the maximum prison facility. So basically, I was working with the offenders, started serving lifetime sentence for murder and other really serious crimes. So I was there for about 6 years. And while I was working for the state, I noted that my job was always at risk because of the budget cut. And with the changing economy, I knew it could be very different 30 years from the road, and I might not have Social Security at that time. So I knew I needed to find a different way of my future. And at that time, I still did not know what I really wanted to do with my life. I was not really happy with where I was working for the state and call it a career, you know. So I started looking into a couple of different businesses, like a multi-level marketing business, and that really inspired me, and that gave me a new perspective about life and how I can get started by working in business and all that. But I did not figure out that I liked real estate yet at that time. So I tried a couple of different businesses, trying to figure out what I really wanted to do, and I failed a lot of them. And I would get up really early almost every day, networking with people, trying to build my business. And after work, I'd be studying, learning, trying to find my way around, you know, trying to figure something out. It took a long time and a couple of years to figure out what I really wanted to do. And then while working for the state, I started getting dizzy spells, and I actually passed out at one point. And I fell and just collapsed. And then, so I went to see the doctor and I had some tests, and it turned out I had a regular heartbeat. So the doctor said that I would need to get a pacemaker. I did not want to get a pacemaker. So I put it off on hold for a little bit. But I noticed my dizzy spells were getting worse and worse and worse, to the point that it was happening all the time. And I was so close to passing out while I was driving, which is dangerous. So finally went in to see the doctor. I had to go in. Well, I want to back up. Before I got my surgery, and during that time, I actually died in my sleep 3 times. And I found a hand on my chest, and it like jump-started my heart. And I woke up all of a sudden, gasping for breath. So I knew that God wanted me alive, and I've always been a firm believer of God, you know, and he wants me alive for a reason, so I can share my story with a lot of people out there. And then shortly after that, I went in and got my surgery, and I got my pacemaker, And then I finally started reading a lot of self-help books, like Think and Grow Rich, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And then finally I started to find the right people to learn about real estate investing. So I bought a course on wholesaling. So that's how I got into real estate. So I bought a course and they had transcripts that I was able to read, because a lot of courses out there, they don't have a transcript or a caption. So I could not really learn anything. Always had to get my money back. And I had to learn a lot of things the hard way over time. So that was one of the challenges of being deaf over time. And so I finally started learning about real estate. And then I went to a conference, and there was one person that was willing to pay for my interpreter services. And they're very expensive as well, because most people would not pay for an interpreter. I have to get a team of interpreters. So, and they might charge like $75 each per hour. So for a whole week in conference, it can easily cost $3,000, which is more than I could afford at the time. And, you know, and that's more than what I would be paying to go to the conference and for the travel, the hotel and everything, which was not really fair. It gave me a really unfair advantage. Only one person in my lifetime actually paid for an interpreter for me to go to the conference, which is frustrating. And so after a few short months after that, and I decided to take the plunge in wholesaling. I borrowed a couple $1,000 so I had money for the earnest money deposit. And then I put a couple of properties under contract. And then shortly after, I found a buyer to buy one of my property. And then I actually hired like two people to work under me for the wholesaling business. And I decided, okay, I think I got everything going. It should be enough to go ahead and get started and go ahead and quit my job. So I literally burned my bridge and I quit my state job, my steady income. And I took a risk just to get started in real estate. It was a big risk. And I do not really recommend doing that until you actually get a couple of deals under your belt and make sure you have a business that works and you have a couple of solid deals, you know, income coming in. Because I started running low on money. It was very hard to figure things out going forward, you know.
So about what time, is when we're talking about this, just so I kind of get an idea. So like what year? So you had worked for the Department of Corrections for a few years, and then you decided to start, you know, trying to get into some conferences and learning more about real estate. At roughly kind of like what period in time was this? Like how many years ago? And like what can you give us, like, you know, some approximate dates, like years in which you kind of made these transitions, just so people can kind of get an idea of, you know, what market you were going into? Because the real estate market's been all over the place, you know, in the past 10 years that I've been involved in investing in real estate. So give us a little bit of a just like some timestamps on a few of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I started working for the state in 2007 until I left my job in May of 2013. And that was right when I was turning 30. So at that time, as you know, the market was going down. So that's why my job was always a risk. So that politicians were, you know, having a lot of budget cuts so they could spend money elsewhere and all that. So that's when I really knew that there's no such thing as job security. And then finally, in about the last 2 years, 2012, 2013, that's when I started reading a lot of self-help books and real estate investing books. And I finally started buying some courses in the last 6 months or so before I actually quit my job. So I did not take a lot of time to really jump into the game and learn what I could to get started. So that was over 9 years ago now, back in 2013, when I actually left my job. And then from that point on, that's really when I started to accelerate the learning curve about real estate investing. So I first started out as a wholesaler for the first few years, and then I started doing a couple of fixer-uppers once I got a couple more capital, and I learned how to utilize hard money lenders. So I started buying properties, fix them up for a profit. And then I moved up to small rental properties like duplex, triplex, and all that. And I also taught finance my church for 1 year at one point. And I was also able to help a couple of people get involved in real estate investing. And now I'm at a point in my life where I just want to focus on apartment investing, because I noticed I can get more money from more rental income under one roof versus a lot of them small properties, because that's a lot of properties to manage and delegate and have to drive all over the place to manage the small properties. And I noticed when a tenant leaves the property for a single family residential property, then I have no income for that. So with a bigger property, if one or two tenant moves, I still have income coming in. And I just noticed it's a lot safer and I can make more money over time. And it's just safer and more consistent over time.
So let's kind of look at your beginnings in real estate, because again, your journey, you know, from the beginning of your life and what you've overcome to getting, you know, into, you know, several different industries is quite frankly amazing. But what were some, so you coming into real estate, you know, around 2013, that's kind of roughly when I got my start as well in the investing space and being really heavily involved in real estate. And yeah, it was a really different market back then. I just remember a lot of we were handling a lot of like REO purchases from big banks and things back then. There was a really, really robust wholesale market, at least in our area in Florida. So a few things, you know, getting into wholesaling, you know, you took some courses, you know, you learned some things. Tell us a few things about some of your like biggest wins and also biggest setbacks in doing wholesaling. And also what market were you operating in? I know you're out in the Northwest. So what kind of markets were you operating in when you were doing wholesaling? And let's just kind of look at that for a second.
Yeah, for wholesaling, okay. But my biggest win, really, learning the industry about investing in real estate, it gave me a whole new perspective of all the opportunities out there and how I can make a lot more money through business and all the networking, connecting with a lot of amazing people. That was something I never really learned growing up. Because I think most of us growing up were taught a certain way. We're taught to go to school, go to college, get a degree, get married, have a job, and work till we retire and hope we have enough for retirement with a 401k. So that's a very different perspective. So I find it to be a huge blessing to be able to get out of that, you know, trip. And I know the opportunity more, and it's given me a whole new inspiration for life and giving me more motivation. And it's what excites me to get up every day and go learn new things and invest in real estate, which is really exciting. So for me, that's really the biggest win. Even though it had not exactly been smooth sailing, and there's been a lot of challenges, and I've learned a lot of things the hard way as well.
Yeah, so,
so
let's
that's
go
part of the learning.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what are some of the harder lessons that you learned getting into real estate? You know, obviously, like you said, some of the biggest benefits were kind of learning how to, you know, engage with people in different ways, the value of networking, the value of, you know, just getting out there and talking to people, which is even for, you know, people across the spectrum of comfortability with engaging with people. You know, you have introverts, you have extroverts, but I think everyone, no matter which kind of side of the aisle you fall on, with regard to your, you know, your kind of your social prowess, always tends to underestimate the power of networking and just getting out there. It's more than just kind of being, you know, being able to go up to a stranger with a friendly hello. It's engaging, following up, and, you know, building that network of trying to add value to your relationships. So obviously that's something I hammer home, but it's often overlooked because it's one of those things that's free. It doesn't cost you anything to go up and talk to someone and try to just, you know, follow back up with them, see what they're doing, see how you can maybe add value to what they're doing. It costs you absolutely zero to do that. You don't need some fancy course. You know, humans are social by nature. So just kind of leaning into that. Again, it's simple. And it's something that I always like to kind of reiterate, because every single person that I've talked to on here with in any scope of investing, I've talked to people that run commercial cleanup for biohazard and drug lab cleanups. And I've talked to people that do commercial and industrial real estate. I've talked to single family developers, and all of them, kind of the one core focus, besides real estate for one form or fashion, which is a big proponent of what we talk about and focus on, is again, that factor of, you know, the human element being so important in this. And, you know, I appreciate you that you bring that up. So, you know, from there, again, that's one of the big benefits you said. What are some of the harder lessons that you had to learn getting into real estate?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. I've kind of learned as I went on that the networking very important. You know, I got a lot better at that and being deaf. And sometimes I might be a little socially illiterate or something, or whatever the best term is for that, because I always had to learn things the hard way. So like when I first started out with wholesaling, and I went ahead and connected with a local realtor and did a couple of market research, and I actually started in the St. Louis market, even though I lived all the way out in Idaho and Washington State at the time. So I'm already, you know, long distance. I should learn everything by the book from the wholesaling course that I bought. So I connected with a local realtor and found a couple of cheap properties. I went ahead and put them under contract. And I worked really hard to find buyers. I actually had a list of cash buyers. And I'll send out letters to those people, try to build a connection with those people. But a lot of them would not actually buy the property. And there was a time limit to sell the property and supply the earnest money and get them sold. You know, usually you have 30 days to do that. And I locked up like 6 or 7 properties at that time at the beginning, and they all backfired on me except for one property, which I eventually closed on. And of course, the realtor got really mad at me because I kind of wasted their time with the process. And I felt really bad about that. That was not my intention, you know. I'm trying to follow the script of the wholesaling course I learned. And then I'm trying to connect with the buyer. I'm trying to create a win-win situation with a realtor. And I'm hurting them and making them mad in the process. So I stopped doing that. I had to take a step back and learn reverse wholesaling, which means I would find the cash buyers first. And I'll find what they're looking for and what they really want. And I can focus on finding property based on their criteria. So that saved a lot of time and a hassle. I'm just locking up properties, hoping I'm gonna sell them to a wholesaler and investor, and you know, so that was some of my challenges. And the same thing, I bought so many courses, and a lot of the courses were the same thing, or I didn't learn extra information from that, or they now have transcripts, and I could not have an interpreter for that. So I ended up getting a lot of my money back. So that kind of slowed down my learning curve, where I could have gone a whole lot faster in the process. Same after that early intended one, which my mentor was willing to pay for the interpreter. And after that, I have not really gone to a lot of conferences without an interpreter because they would not pay for an interpreter. So I had to do things the really hard way. But I just kept working at it because I knew I could do this, and I eventually got better at it once I figured it out, and keep on tweaking, adjusting, and finding methods that works best for my situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that you bring up as well. You know, it's easy to go out, you know, and look at the theory of wholesaling and say, okay, great. Yeah, what I do, I go out and I find these properties, I get them under contract, and then I go find people to sell them to. Well, it's, you know, it's a lot harder when you're under the gun of 30 days or whatever your agreed upon closing date is to then have to go out and find people. You know, I think, and I don't think I've ever really heard anyone, you know, explicitly kind of break it down into such simple pieces of saying, you know, reverse the process, find people that are looking, you know, build up your buyer network first. And I think it's implied, and I've been to a lot of these courses too. I think it's kind of implied, but it's not necessarily always very explicit when, you know, the importance of saying, hey, make things as easy on yourself as possible. Can you go out and lock up a bunch of properties, wholesaling and sign contracts and then find buyers? Yeah, absolutely. But you know what's going to make your life easier? If you already have people, you know, we're interested, you know what their price points, you know what they're looking for, you then in turn go find those properties. So that way it's 1 or 2 phone calls and maybe 4 or 5 days and you're done, as opposed to, you know, kind of sweating it, looking at the clock, you know, thinking, hey, you know, there's a good chance I might lose my nut and my deposit on this. And also, you know, really kind of irk the other people that you're trying to add value to. You know, you find these people that are trying to sell their home. You know, you're trying to add value by the fact of, hey, you went out, got this and got it sold quickly for them. And you know, no one's really going to want to give a referral back to the person, you know, that caused a lot of headache in the process. So great point to make there. Now, you know, from there you indicated that, and I think it's a pretty normal trajectory for a lot of people. You know, wholesaling's, and I hesitate to use the word easy because the level of difficulty for everyone is across the board, but it's kind of the low hanging fruit. It's the least expensive option to get into real estate. So options and wholesaling are what cost the least amount of money of, or least amount of capital from you as the investor personally to get involved with. You know, obviously the next step from there would be things like single family homes. So, you know, you kind of built up your experience in real estate, and how long did you mainly just focus on wholesaling before you really started to make the jump into single family?
Yeah, I started on wholesaling and I did that for about 2 years. It was very challenging. So I'm not really getting a steady income. So that was really hard for me. And at that time, the market was starting to go up. So it was getting more expensive. And it was harder to find deals that were still cheap and really affordable for what investors wanted. So I knew I could not sustain that over time. So that's what, and I also during that time, I kept on learning during that time about a couple more courses about how to fix your upper, some other courses as well. So that's when I got into fixer uppers and started focusing on that. And I went on to a couple of fixer uppers over time. And that's when I started learning more about financing as well. And I went back to working as a loan processor for a hard money lender for 1 year and with a conventional lender for 1 year as well. And then that eventually led to me getting licensed as a mortgage broker. So I have a network connection with over 100 lenders nationwide for commercial single family property. So I can help a lot of people in the process. Because I noted a lot of people were always asking me for referrals at that time. So I realized I could make a business out of it as well and help people with their financing need and get paid as well. Because I'm able to build a connection with a lot of lenders and a lot of other people that wanted to get into the real estate investing game as well. So that's really a blessing to be able to help a lot of people in so many different ways.
Yeah, that's really cool. I don't think a lot of people I didn't realize that when you initially kind of given the trajectory of how you went in real estate. I don't think a lot of people really kind of go from like the real estate buying side of things to the financing of the money side and then back into buying. Most of the time, at least with the people that I've met over the years, you know, either that they kind of, most of the people that deal in money and lending money typically stick to that. You don't find too many of those people that own houses. And when they do, they're typically not happy about it because something did not go right with that loan and now they're stuck with a house. So that's interesting. So you went wholesaling and then you kind of got into the lending side of things, went hard money. Then you also went to the more conventional route, commercial and everything else like that. So, and I think you said that was around 2013 or so is when you kind of made that switch into financing. So I'll kind of ask you the same question. What were some of the, you know, biggest wins or the biggest things that you took away of benefit from that? And then what were also, you know, maybe what was some of the biggest challenges that you ran into in moving into the financing realm?
Yeah, okay. When I finally got back to finance, I did a couple of fixer-uppers. That's actually a lot harder than I thought because a lot of things can go wrong with a fixer-upper. I've had some crazy things happen. Well, I mean, you can follow the script and I'm hoping to make like $40,000 in profit after all repairs, the purchase repair and the hard money loan and everything. But as I realized through the process, it always ends up taking longer than expected to go through the repair process to get that back on the market for resale. And I might cough up another $10,000-$15,000 repair or more sometime. And then you left it on the market and you end up paying more in interest payment to a hard money lender. So that's more money out of your pocket. And then equity. And then and over time, somebody might come in and offer $10,000-$20,000 less from the original asking price. And then before you know it, for all of your hard work from 6 months to 1 year, and you only make like $5,000-$10,000 in the end, which is really frustrating. And when you're hoping to make $40,000 from your initial assessment. So I found that to be a lot harder than expecting. Well, I did okay that in one of my properties. And I went through the whole process and then I put it on for sale on the market. And it flooded, and I actually had flood insurance at that one property, and it was a big disaster. So, and flood insurance would not pay for the repairs I needed. So, what was the point of having flood insurance in the first place? You know, with a hard money lender. So, I went over 1 year because I had to put in extra repairs out of pocket and all the delays and everything with that property. And I also had a sewer line that collapsed in the front yard from that property to the main sewer line, which I had to pay as well, out of pocket for $4,000, and the ARV was $250,000. So yeah, that after I got it back on the market, nobody would buy the property, and it plummeted to $160,000 when I finally got rid of it. So when it was all said and done, I actually lost $90,000 at that one property. So I was like, my biggest headache, really. And the big learning curve, I learned a lot of new things on that. So that was my fault, really, because I saw that I could make like $60,000, $70,000 on that one property, but technically, even in a flood zone, I thought I could be in and out quickly and make the money on that. I'll never invest in a flood zone. I don't care how good you think the number is. Don't do it. It's not worth the risk.
No, yeah, that's a great point. I was about to ask you, you know, from the issues that you ran into with that property, obviously, floods are gonna, they ruin everything from drywall to sheetrock foundations. So don't buy into flood zone is kind of what you took out of your rehabbing days. And then from there, I would say, from the perspective of, you know, obviously, I think you're kind of alluding to it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem like you kind of go through this. And one of the big kind of threads with all of this is that you put in a lot of work to all of these different aspects of real estate that you were involved in. And I think one of the kind of frustrations that you've been, you know, kind of hinting at is just, you know, the return on your time. Like you said, with the property that you put in all this effort and work to get done, and then you make, you know, $5,000, $10,000 for four or five, you know, for how, you know, like 2 to 4 months of your time, you know, that's barely minimum wage after it's all said and done. So I think it's kind of fair to say that you kind of saw that, you know, you needed to increase the, you know, throughput of your investing work that you're doing in order to be able to get those returns. And most people, when they're involved in real estate, see commercial real estate as kind of the next logical jump. For the same amount of work, you can get, you know, 5-10 times the doors and the income from a property. So now let's kind of focus on your transition from the single family realm into the multifamily commercial space, to where I think I kind of understand where the clip happened. So with that said about the properties that you had issue with, and I think it's, you know, fair to say, and correct me if, you know, I'm missing the mark here, is that most of your kind of forays into real estate, one of the frustrations I think that, you know, you kind of hinted at would be that the amount of work that you put in wasn't necessarily commensurate with the returns that you were getting. Because it sounds like for me, from what you said, you know, you're putting in a lot of work when it came to wholesaling, when it came to getting involved in single family homes with, you know, that one property you talked about, you know, collapsed sewer lines, all this kind of stuff. And then putting in all this work in properties that, you know, you're expecting one return, but after everything's said and done, you worked your butt off for 3-4 months and you end up making $5,000 to $10,000, which, you know, if math is correct, you know, that's roughly minimum wage for a lot of work that you're putting in. And I think a lot of people, it's fair to say, when they're in this situation, especially in real estate, start looking at, you know, throughput efficiency. You know, what can I do to make the same amount of effort worth, you know, exponentially more? And the easy thing to look at is commercial real estate. If you put in the same amount of work to get two properties, so let's say three properties, single family homes, up, rented, flipped, whatever your strategy is looking to do, that's, you know, maybe a full-time amount of work for one person to do. Obviously, if you scale that, you get some more people. But for the same amount of work, one person can go out and get involved in commercial real estate where maybe you have 50 or 100 or hopefully more doors or potential sources of income that greatly increase, you know, the throughput efficiency of, you know, you're inputting X and getting Y and making sure that that is a, you know, increasing multiple. So let's focus a little bit on, you know, you had those frustrations and what you said about single family homes, don't buy in a flood zone. Couldn't agree with you more on that. The one thing specifically when my wife and I bought our house we're currently in is being at the highest point in our county, because we're on a peninsula in Florida and, you know, it's a lot of flooding and we're on the coast. So yeah, we think we're about 29, 30 feet above sea level, which is nice. So it takes a big wave to get us. So from there, you know, what are some things, you know, what was kind of the writing on the wall and how did you kind of first get involved in commercial real estate from your experiences in single family?
Yes. Okay. Well, I want to back up from my experience. As you can see, I kept on learning and gaining a lot of experience from the lending and investing side. And then while I kept on learning, and I finally learned about real estate investing and rental property. So it took a couple of years to get to that point. So finally, I jumped into the rental property. I learned that there was a big difference between active investing and passive investing. And I do not want to keep working hard for the little money that I was making in wholesaling. And and fixer-uppers, and I think it's a little risky. So if I get in an accident down the road, and with my health challenges, my experience, so anything can happen, and there's no way I'll be able to keep that coming in to make the money. So I knew I needed future. I needed to think about my future and my long-term investment. So I started investing in rental property. And I found that's the best way to go because I can learn. I can make passive income through the rental income, and through the rental income, that also pays down the mortgage payment, and I'll grow in appreciation over time. And I can buy a lot of property. And I actually learned a couple of shortcuts for investing in rental property. Most people think that you have to work like 25, 30 years, you save up just enough for a down payment for one rental property. But I think that's like putting all of your eggs in one basket. So I learned a shortcut using the BRRRR strategy so that I'll buy discounted properties for rental property at 70% after repair value. Then and after I clean it up, and I can refinance the loan at 75 to 80% after repair value. So I'll get my money back that I had to put down for that initial purchase with a hard money lender or a long-term investor. Or if I put up cash to clean up and buy the property and get it rented, and then I get my money back. Now I can buy another rental property. So I can kind of rinse and repeat the process. So I realized that there's a better way to buy rental property the faster way. That was really awesome. But as I said earlier, I'm not getting as much rental income for smaller property because the property is expensive and you only have one or two rental income for one property. So that eventually led me to a commercial property because I realized I can make a lot more money under one roof. So I have like 8 to 12 units under one roof. So I save a lot of money. And for a single property, if I had a plumbing issue that cost me $3,000, ouch, and that takes a lot of my money. And I actually would be at a loss for like 2 months, 3 months to finally be back to positive because of the loss. But if I had a commercial property, I had more income coming in, and if I paid $3,000 for the same plumbing issue, then I thought I'm still profitable after all the expenses and everything. So it's really the same amount of work for the due diligence process. So I really like commercial property, and now that's really my main focus going forward. And I've been networking with all the right people and building experience based on all my experience leading up to that point.
So would you say that, you know, obviously all of your experience has kind of played into where you are currently in your real estate career, but is there, you know, one thing that you think stands out that you learned that really has helped you the most from your previous experiences in real estate to where you are currently now in commercial real estate? What kind of things would you say are most beneficial to take away from your time in wholesaling and finance and single family homes that are helping you the most be successful, helping you to be the most successful now in commercial real estate?
Well, thinking back, I can't really say what my main experience was. It really was just the journey, the learning curve through everything, and one thing led to another as I kept realizing that there was a better way of investing in real estate. And I was very persistent. I never gave up. I really strongly believed that is my path. And I realized it's my passion. I love real estate investing. I love finance. I love helping people and figuring out a way to be financially free for my future. And that's really what kept pushing me forward, trying to find a better way. And one thing led to another as I kept learning and growing to get to where I'm at right now. And I realized that where I'm at is where I need to be. That's what I want to be doing. And I think everybody really doesn't have a whole lot of money to get started in real estate. So wholesaling is really a good way to get started, even though that could be challenging. Same with fixer-uppers. But I learned a lot about financing and how everything really works. And I can minimize my mistakes by starting smaller rather than jump into apartment building, which you can make a lot of mistakes. You'll lose a lot of money in the process because it's a lot more expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about your first deal in commercial real estate. What did that look like when you initially decided to take the first step into commercial real estate? How did that look for you? Were there some concerns? What kind of lessons did you learn from your first stab at commercial real estate?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my first rental property was a triplex I bought a couple of years ago. And I actually used a prime investor for that one, which was awesome for my first deal. Could add enough experience from working as a lender and from all my experience investing in real estate, analyzing deals up to that point. So I knew I could do that. And I have somebody that trusted me enough to lend me the money. So I went ahead and bought a triplex and I cleaned up the whole unit and I refinanced it. So I was able to do that. But one big mistake that I learned with that is that I had to pay for all the utilities. I would recommend that you have a separate meter for all the utilities, for the electricity and the gas if possible, because that's extremely expensive. I remember I was paying like $5,000 a year for just electricity and gas. So that took a lot out of my money, out of my profit, just for a single family residential property. So that's where you can really save a lot of money. Same with apartment building. You really want to separate the meters for that. If possible, that's one of the biggest experiences I learned. And there's always going to be some tenant turnover thing. And the business process of managing a property, you want to find the right property manager. I do not like locking myself in contract with a property manager. They have a lot of fees where I have to pay 1 month upfront rent, and then 1 month, and then 10% fee every month for their services. And they charge a lot of other fees to manage things and for a market to evict the tenant and for finding a new tenant, and that gets really expensive and I actually lose money on that. So I found a good local property manager that I could work with that just charges a flat fee of 10% of the rent. That includes all the marketing, all that, because I believe that's their job to find new tenants and evict them, except they'll pay for the eviction process for the court and other repairs and everything. So that's some of the things that I learned, and I got better at finding the right property manager to work with and minimize my costs, my expenses, and my risks involved with that.
Okay, great. That's an awesome point. It's one thing I never really would have thought about is just how important property management is, because you're right. It can be, I just kind of in general think, you know, property management, 10% gross rents and it's done, but all these property managers are different. So making sure that you get someone that is, you know, providing you the right service, the right value for the right price is, you know, an important tenet for any type of investing, making sure you get value for the, you know, amount of money you're putting up for it. Now, currently, are you investing in your current local market of the Pacific Northwest, or for your commercial real estate ventures, are you looking outside of your area? Because I know it's a pretty saturated market in the Pacific Northwest for apartment buildings. So are you looking in other places outside of kind of your local physical location for these deals?
Yeah, my local market, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, everything overpriced, everything should doubled or more in the last 2 years. Crazy. A lot of people are moving up here because Coeur d'Alene is a really popular place to be. Same with Spokane. So I do not really invest locally because everything's overpriced and there's not a lot of opportunities because the town's a little bit smaller. But my main focus is investing in the Midwest mostly, or the smaller states from Ohio, Indiana, all the way down Oklahoma, Texas, and some in the eastern states like North Carolina, South Carolina, Kentucky, some of those areas, because I've noted that I can find a lot of property for a lot less for more bang for my buck. So for example, when I first bought my triplex in Indiana, and I bought it for $17,000 because I had a tired landlord, and I put in about $25,000 to $30,000 repairs. So I was only about $40,000 all in, and now I'm up to about $2,000 a month in rent. But here locally in Coeur d'Alene, I just had my property manager send a deal, and they wanted $580,000 for a duplex, and they're only getting $2,000 a month in rent. So that doesn't even meet the 1% rule or anything. That's way overpriced. So I'm getting the same bang for my buck in the Midwest. So that's why it's a lot easier for me to invest in those areas and make sure I'm making enough money, even though I understand the commercial properties actually focus on the cash flow, how much money you're making, and they base the valuation on your gross income, your net operating income, to determine the valuation. I like single family, which focused on the valuation of the sold property in the area. So that's very different in terms of the valuation and analyzing the figures.
Yeah. Now, is there a certain kind of like door count that you're like looking and liking to focus on? Because it sounds like for me, you're kind of doing this as more of a one-stop shop. You know, you are, it doesn't sound like you have a very large team, which isn't inherently a bad thing, but you know, people do it all sorts of different ways. But is there a certain size of property that you find works well for what you have going on? And if I'm wrong on kind of the team size that you have, feel free to correct me. Or if you find it more beneficial to do things a little bit more on your own, tell us a little bit about that. Because we're kind of coming up a little bit towards the end of how long I like to keep these. So I think that'd be good information for people to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, right now, I'm mostly focused on 20 to 100 units around the Midwest, because that's a good sign to get started. There's not two banks to manage. I'll probably build up to that point over time once I raise more capital with the people that I want to work with through my syndication, which I'm building on right now as well. Anyway, I find that 20 units and up is a lot easier than buying a 10-unit apartment, because it's for the same reason, you're getting less rental income, and you might have repairs and other costs that you have to offset. So I noted that with 20 units and up, you're making just enough income to offset all the repairs and other supply costs that might come along with the property. So I feel a whole lot safer with that. And I try to make a minimum $135 profit per door after all my analysis, including the loan as well. That way I make sure that I'm safe if I don't make at least $135 per door in rental income every month, then I will pass on the deal because that's just too risky. You can use, so if I had 20 units and I had $2,000 repair, all that profit's gone to $100 per door if you do the calculation, right? So really it's not much if you really think about it. A lot of people might think, oh, I have a cash flow, it looks really good, I should be fine, but really $100 per door is not a lot. So you want to make sure you factor everything. And I always try to look at all my risk associated with the property, because I've noted that if I manage my risk, then my upside will take care of itself.
No, awesome points to make. With that said, you know, we're kind of coming up on about 45 minutes for the interview. You know, with all that said, I think we had a really great trajectory of giving people some good information about, you know, just how different of a background and, you know, how you can overcome so many different things, which you certainly have overcome from the stories of your investing to your personal life, overcome an immense amount to get to where you are in life. So, you know, high five, you know, commendations are in order for that. But is there anything that you'd like to leave people with? And then also, if you have anything going on, if you're, you know, looking to network with other people, how can people get in touch with you? You know, this is kind of your time to put out, you know, what you have going on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple of different ways you can reach out to me. Obviously, I have a couple of websites even, but mainly you can email me at zane.gracer@gmail.com. That's the best way to get a hold of me. You can also text me if you want. My number is 503-734-6610. And I'll be happy to help in any way I can. And my main advice really is to find your passion in life. It's not always about the money. I just happen to love real estate, investing, and finance. So I put all my focus and energy into it because I love what I'm doing. I mean, I tried a lot of other business and I wasn't really passionate about it. So it was a lot harder to do, get started in those areas. I put all my main focus and energy into that. And you're going to hit a lot of challenges or hardship. Man, I'm gone through so many things that went wrong, so many heartburn, so much frustration, but I know that this works. So I kept going. I never gave up. You just have to persist and do not give up. You will eventually get there if you don't give up. I promise you, if you happen to lose everything and you suffer a setback, learn from it and then get up and keep going and really believe what you're doing and have a positive mindset and you'll be fine.
All right. Well, fantastic. I think that's a great sentiment to end on. I really appreciate you taking the time today, Zane, to be with us. It's always good to get new and interesting perspectives. And I think you definitely check the box very well for new and interesting perspective on real estate investing. With that said, my name is Alex Perney. If you have any questions or you'd like to get in touch with us, you can always reach Advanta at advantaira.com, or you can reach me directly at 727-754-9954. This has been another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Have a great day. Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.